Hello, this is Dr. Paul Looney for Restoration. This is part two in a series called Out of Egypt, From Bondage to Freedom Through the Wilderness.
What we're going to look at tonight is how our human relationships, in their best moments and their worst moments, prepare us to relate to God. Ultimately, this series is about how our human relationships are not perfect, and they require some protection. That our human relationships are never going to be all that they need to be, and so we need emotional defenses. And Adam and Eve, when they were first brought to life and placed in the garden, could be completely vulnerable without any defense, emotional, spiritual. They didn't even need any physical defenses. They could be naked. They run around barefoot. There weren't any thorns. There weren't any stickers. There wasn't any poison ivy. And so they could be completely unclothed emotionally, spiritually, and physically. I happen to think that's pretty great. My wife doesn't appreciate the physical nakedness part of it as much as I do, but, you know, must be a guy thing. But the point is that in a perfect world, we could be undefended. We could be emotionally unclothed. But we don't live in a perfect world, do we? There are thorns, and it's not safe to run barefoot in a world where there are thorns. It's not safe to be emotionally unclothed or completely vulnerable when there are people who have given themselves over to self-serving, to pride and envy and lust and greed and exploitation. You need a defense. And so Egypt, where we proposed last week, is a biblical picture of a place of refuge, a place of defense, a physical defense in this place, in this case, from the ravages of a physical famine. And the provision of Egypt was God's provision for his people when they needed defending. And they found safety there. They not only survived, but they flourished. They went from 66 people, that's how many people that went to Egypt originally, into a multitude of probably over 2 million people, maybe more than that. There was a bunch of people. And so we can grow a lot in our defenses. And many of us, I'm 55 this year, many of us have lived in our defenses for a long time, and we've not only survived, we've actually flourished in some ways. But there comes a point in every life where God asks us to step away from what's safe, to step out of what's comfortable, to enter in to a more risky way of living. Life in the spirit rather than life in the flesh. And some of you are right there. You're just really struck with the fact that something needs to shift in your life. Something needs to change. You need to be able to do life in a different way. And so tonight, I'm going to look briefly at what the developmental path looks like when we negotiate it as children, when things go well. And I'm going to just whet your appetite for what happens when things go badly. Because the next 4 weeks are going to give us a glimpse into God's plan for reclaiming what was lost in our lives as children. And we're going to look at the parable of the lost sheep, the lost coin, the prodigal son, and the older brother. And we're going to sift through that parable and extract some really powerful principles about how you can find greater joy, peace, freedom, and passion in your life by allowing the kingdom of heaven to interact with you in a fresh way. So let's look at if you want to look at the handout, you probably have two of them. One of them just says relational development. They're very similar, but get the one that just says relational development at the top. And unfortunately, because of time, I'm going to have to go pretty quickly through this. But over the next few weeks, we'll renegotiate these things and dig a little deeper, expand them a little broader. Tonight, we're going to look at what happens when a child is born into the world. We are made in the image of God, and because God is relational, we also are relational. We are made for love. We are made to be in relationship with each other. And when a baby first comes into the world, what is the first thing that you think about a baby doing when he or she is born? What's a cry? The baby cries. And in the first few months of life, anybody have a little infant right now in your home? No infants? Wow. Oh, there's one over there. In those first few months, the baby cries a lot, right? The cry is a signal. When the baby is first born, it may be a signal of shock or distress. But almost always, that's the first thing the baby does. What does the cry signify? Need, desire, longing. The baby needs attention, warmth, cleansing, food, all kinds of things a baby needs to survive and to thrive. And that cry, really, this is the kid's big task at that stage of life. That's the big thing that a kid has to do. He has to learn how to cry, how to get the attention of those around him to get his needs met. And really, if you think about it, that's the fundamental need, that's the fundamental task that we all have, to learn how to get our own needs met by exerting our own effort. Isn't that cool? The baby, all he has is lungs and vocal cords. Really, he can't go, tug on mom's dress, can't use words, can't send a text message or, send an email. The kid can only cry, and he does it well. What happens when the kid cries? If everything goes well, what happens? Mom comes. The caregiver responds. In fact, mothers are made for love. Mothers are nurturing. They are maternal. And even the very body of a mother responds to that cry. If it's a hungry cry, her body physiologically prepares to feed the baby by a process called letdown, that the milk that's being produced in her body is delivered to the portal so that the baby can latch on and receive nourishment. It's just the greatest thing, that the cry stimulates a response. What we're told is that even in a relationship with God, when we cry out to him, what does that do in God? It creates a softness, a tenderness, and a readiness to meet us in our need. So that this cry of need is our fundamental, basic human task, is to learn how to express need in a powerful way. And every time that need is expressed by the child and the mother responds to that need, we have something called bonding, right? Bonding is the first task of every relationship. When you meet someone, your first job is to forge some kind of connection by gaining eye contact, by shaking their hand, by some verbal expression. If you do not form a bond with the person, there is very little chance that there will be any meaningful exchange between you. For there to be a flow of information or a flow of goodwill or help of any kind, we need a bond. We need an attachment. We need to connect with people. And in those first few months of life, that process of the baby crying and the mother responding time after time after time, and it's hundreds of times, maybe thousands of times in those first few months that the baby cries and somebody comes. And each time, the world becomes a safer place for that kid. The world becomes a place where that child realizes, if I exert myself, I can get my needs met. Powerful thing. What psychologists call a secure base. That's down there on your page. A place of belonging. It's where the child begins to learn that even when something is not in their visual field, they're still there. When a baby is very small, if you have a ball and you show the baby the ball, if you take it outside of their field of vision, as far as they're concerned, the ball ceases to exist. But in those first few months of life, the child realizes that even if mom is not present to eyesight, she still exists. And that empowers the baby to cry out even if the baby can't see the mom. If the mother does not come readily enough, what does the baby do? Ramp it up. Yeah, the baby screams. She screams. He wails. A healthy kid will do whatever it takes to get his need met. Well, unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. Some of you grew up in homes where there was a lack of bonding. You had a mother who was strung out on drugs or alcohol, who had postpartum depression, who was not available to you. In my case, my mom got spinal meningitis when I was 6 weeks old. And there was a break in the bond such that there was a rift or a break in the attachment, in the bond. What happens when things go badly? When things go badly, the child withdraws. The child does not stay connected, but instead withdraws into isolation. Tell you what I probably should do is go through the positive progression, and then we'll go back and fill in what happens when things break down. Hopefully that'll get us through it in a timely way. Better put my watch up here, so it's actually Joe's watch. Thanks, Joe. Okay, so where are we on time? Okay, good. Okay, so if all goes well, bonding occurs, and a baby or a child feels secure, feels safe, feels comfortable, and begins to grow. As a child grows, he or she begins to move around, learns to roll over, pull up, actually begins to learn how to crawl, even stand and walk. And as a child is healthy and has a strong bond, he or she will begin to explore. They'll begin to crawl around the room, maybe find a dead roach and stick it in his mouth. They like to put everything in their mouth, right? Kids will do all kinds of things. And what happens is that as they begin to explore, the mother, who is always presented a positive frame of reference for them, who's always been on their side, so to speak, always mirroring their emotional response. If the baby's happy, the mom mirrors happiness. If the baby's sad, the mom mirrors sadness. Well, when things go well, the child gets to a place where he's out exploring, doing things, and suddenly mom enters the room, and let's say the kid is throwing food on the floor, or crawling up on the cabinet in the kitchen, or eating Ajax from under the counter, or sticking something in the light socket, or eating a dead roach. Mom comes in the room, and the kid, who up until this point believes mom wants what I want, right? Suddenly, mom comes in the room, and what does she do? She goes, oh, yay, let me have some roach too. No, she doesn't join the kid in the food, you know, putting food on the floor, or smearing in their hair, or whatever. Instead, she says something different. What does she say? No, stop that. You know, she may slap the kid's hand, but she does something that at that moment in time is a great shock to the child. Because the child really has come to believe that mom is kind of an extension of me, right? I want something. Mom is there for me. I'm unhappy. She makes me happy. You know, she is, up until that point, is always in sync with the kid during bonding. But when we move to releasing or separation, suddenly the child hears this word and before long learns how to say it back, right? The word, as you said, is no. The child hears it a lot in that period of time from 18 to 24 months on until they turn 3 or 4 years old, depending on the particular kid and how they go through the developmental stage. But there's a reason we call it the terrible twos, right? Because from about 18 months of age until about 3 years, the child is moving from bonding to separation. And it's a very important stage of development. It is unpleasant, no doubt, for the parents. But it's so important because while attachment is vital for relationship, assertion or separation or individuation is equally important. It's important for a kid to be able to assert his or her will even when it is in direct opposition to the will of the parent. Now, if you think about it, that's kind of a gutsy thing for a kid to do. You know, here's this little bitty toddler saying no to this big person who could effectively squash them, you know, who could withhold food and, you know, lock them in the room forever or the attic or whatever. But the kid, if he's healthy, is able to just puff up and say, no, you know, whatever it is. You want ice cream? No. Because a healthy kid is so bent on being able to maintain a sense of personal power and autonomy, even in the face of a parent who is determined to bring obedience or order or structure to the child's life. When my sister's son was at this stage, she went into his room and he was smearing poop on the walls. Actually happened more than once. She was not happy. It was not something that she could join in on and, you know, finger paint. She had to set limits. And the second stage, while this is all about connecting and overcoming limits in relationship, the second stage is about establishing limits, establishing boundaries. What's another word that you hear a lot from a two-year-old besides the word no? Mine. Yeah, mine. That was Debbie's first word. Doesn't surprise me. Mine. Because the child begins to realize that not everything is under my control. I can't always have the cookie when I want it. You know, our oldest child is like, you know, I want a cookie. I'm like, no, you can't have one. But I want one. You know, he's like, if I want it, it should be mine. But the child realizes that even though I can't always have a cookie, I can't always, you know, have my passy or what, well, I can't ever always have everything. There are certain things that I can have. And the pacifier actually is something that for a lot of kids, that's mine, my blankie, my toy, whatever it is. A healthy kid is very clear about what is mine and nobody else can have it. Nobody else can take it from me. That actually is a very healthy thing. And what we're going to find is even in a relationship with God, there is a time in our spiritual development when we feel as though God is against us. I want the cookie and God is not coming forward with the cookie. And it seems like I should get it. It seems like it would be a good thing. The thing I'm asking for from God, from my point of view, seems totally good, just like that two-year-old and the cookie. And yet, mom, like a good, any good, God, like any good mom, is saying, no, can't have it. I'm not going to give it to you. And sometimes there's an explanation and sometimes there's not. But a healthy kid stays in the mix and asserts his or her will. We're going to look at what that looks like spiritually as we go through this process. So once that happens, the child who bumps up against those limits and says no and tries to push the limits, if the mother is able to provide a smooth barrier where she doesn't get hooked into her own issues of authority and control, if she's able to just let the kid have a tantrum, then the child eventually will come to a place of acceptance. We'll go through a grieving process of grieving that absolute control and autonomy that we all wish for and come to a place of acceptance where the child can move from this terrible two state to the 3 or 4 year old who begins to learn about yielding, about accommodating. What does accommodation mean? We accommodate whenever we are able to bring our behavior or thinking into line with some other structure or agenda. We accommodate or yield when we're entering the freeway, we adjust our speed to the flow of traffic. When we see a yield sign, if there's a car coming, then we accommodate, we slow down or stop until the other car is gone, then we take our turn. And healthy people are able to release their need to have ultimate control over everything and be able to accommodate and yield in relationship with others. At this stage of development, children move from just being aware of mom to having a greater awareness of dad as well. The mom, for the first 3 years, I think the mom is really the critical parent. Although dad begins to be really important in this second stage, because dads are really good with limits. Dads are also really good with more risk-taking behaviors, and they'll throw the kid in the air and roughhouse with them and play with them. And dads tend to be not as sad about the infancy stage going away. They're actually kind of glad that the kid is beginning to show some initiative, beginning to show some individuality. But the third stage of development is when dad and mom really need to be a team, and they need to begin to demonstrate that everybody is in a chain of command, that everyone has to respond to authority, that the mother and dad will defer to one another to demonstrate that to the kid. You know, the kid says, can I do such and such? And the dad says, go talk to your mom. The mom says, have you asked your dad? And so we learn that all of us have to respond to authority. And ultimately, we begin to demonstrate to kids that even we have to respond to God's authority and that everything we do is in response to a design, that we all have a place where we fit. But as a child moves from this separation stage to yielding or accommodation or this meekness stage, then they're going to ask a lot of questions because they're trying to figure out how things work. What's the question, the one-word question you hear so often from a three-year-old? Why? They say it a lot because they're really struggling with the way things work. Why can't I have what I want? The mom says, go put your shoes on. Kid says, why? Well, we need to go to the store. Why? Well, we're going to go get groceries. Why? Well, we need to eat. Why? That's the way God made us. Why? I don't know. Put your shoes on. We're going to the store. There's a time when a healthy parent does need to say, because I said. There are times when there is not an answer that you can give a kid. But time after time, a healthy parent is able to give an answer that makes it easier for the child to accommodate, to yield, to adopt a teachable and obedient attitude. And a healthy child really at this stage begins to reap the rewards of being in relationship. They learn from their teachers, from their parents, from their older brother or sister. They learn to ride a bike. They learn to count to 10. They learn to say their alphabet. So many things. At this stage, kids are like sponges, and they really want to learn. And it sets them on a good path for life to be able to find out how systems work, to get rewarded and avoid punishment. And healthy kids are quick to work the system. They're good at, figuring out how they can get what they want out of the system. Sometimes they're too good at it. But it actually is a great skill for a person to be able to enter into a system and figure out what do I need to do to get what I want in this situation to avoid punishment or a problem. If that goes well, then the child goes through from about 3 to 12 in this kind of accommodation stage where they're just really learning, growing. It's a really fun time of being a parent, I think. Your kids are just so cool at that age. I mean, they're just so fun. But about 11 or 12, if they're a girl, especially because girls mature a little bit faster than guys, or if, 12, 13, 14, if they're a boy, they begin to move into a stage where they have got to sort of start over again in terms of establishing a sense of identity. And while they've been very yielded to the parents, they begin to kind of start chomping at the bit to have more freedom, to have more autonomy again. If they kind of go back to this separating mode again, where they want to be able to make their own decisions, where they want to learn how to make money for themselves, learn how to drive, they want to date, they want to launch out, they don't want to have to go places with mom and dad. And they begin to pursue life from a different point of view. Rather than trying to figure out what everybody else expects of them, if things are going well, they've eaten the bread of instruction, it's become a part of them so that now they start being driven by internal drives and motives. It's not so much about pleasing mom and dad or getting rewards or avoiding punishment. It's about being who I want to be. They begin to have a vision for who they want to be. They want to be a dancer, a doctor, a lawyer, tennis player, whatever it is. They begin to have dreams and want to pursue those dreams. And healthy parents begin the process of launching so that that child can really say yes to life, can live from inside. The word down here, assimilation, is a word that is used when someone comes into a culture like someone moves to the United States from another country, as they assimilate, they become a part of our culture. They learn the customs, the idioms, the language, whatever, and they assimilate to the point that they actually become a part of it. In physiology, if you eat something, your body takes something that's external and assimilates it by breaking it down into little bits, and it becomes a part of you. And so in a healthy family where the structures and the rules are based on love, then a child will naturally assimilate the values that are behind those rules. They internalize the values so that rather than being driven by rules or regulations, they're driven from internal sense of desire and longing and sense of value and purpose. They become purpose-driven. Like, how many of you read the book Purpose-Driven Life? That's what God wants for us, and it's what a healthy parent wants for a child, that the child is purpose-driven so that the parent doesn't have to tell them every day what to do. The child doesn't have to call home and say, "Mom, should I have this?" Or, you know, they're serving meatloaf and cheeseburgers at lunch today. What should I have? You know, the kid can make that decision when it comes to signing up for courses at college or who to date or whatever. A healthy child is assimilated healthy values. It doesn't mean they don't ever ask for input, but a healthy parent helps them to figure out who they are, what they want, what values are important to them, and they grow into that. Well, that's kind of what, in a real brief nutshell, what happens when things go well. What we're going to look at the next 4 weeks is what happens when things are broken. And as I said at the beginning, although it's painful when things are broken, it's frustrating when we find ourselves stuck. For many of us, it's our brokenness or our stuckness that will ultimately cause us to engage with God in the most powerful and profound ways. So I hope that over the next few weeks, you'll see yourself in these lost things, and it will challenge and encourage you to engage with God and with other people in a fresh way. So just briefly, and this is just going to kind of whet your appetite for the next 4 weeks, what happens when things go awry? We already said if a mother is not available for a child, that perhaps is the most profound relational problem. A child who is in a situation where there is not a consistent and loving caregiver will often withdraw to the point that they won't eat, they won't engage. In fact, some children who are not bonded will die. They won't survive physically. Others will survive physically, but they will shut down not only on expressing need by crying out, they'll actually shut down on their experience of need. And people who have bonding issues often are cut off from their bodies a little bit. They're cut off from their emotions. They don't know how they feel about things. They don't know what they need. They don't know what they want. You know, people who you ask, you know, "What do you want to eat?" "I don't care." "What do you want to do?" "I don't know." "What are you feeling?" "I don't know." When you hear the words, "I don't," you may be dealing with someone who has bonding issues, who hasn't really connected with their need and the ability to be able to believe that if I reach out for something, I can get it. And so it's just easier not to be in touch with it than to reach out and be disappointed. That's what happens with a lost sheep or someone who withdraws. They shut down on their needs. They withdraw from relationship, particularly if they feel threatened. They want to back away. If there's conflict, if there's risk, they tend to back away from it because they don't have that secure base of confidence to be able to express those needs. Well, if bonding occurs well and the child is moving toward assertion, the child is starting to feel their oats or whatever, but they're in a relationship with a mother who is very good at bonding but not so good at separation. Some mothers get so much of their emotional value in their children that when the child begins to assert their own will, the mother is very threatened by it. And she will slap them down or she will give in. And either thing has a profound and terrible effect on that growing child because it gives the child the message that it is not safe to assert yourself. It is not safe to say no. It is not, there is nothing that you can claim as mine. And those children tend to revert back to a sort of a regressive response of clinging or pleasing. That child feels like that they cannot share all that they are. You'll hear mothers sometimes say to children, "What happened to my sweet little Susie? You're not my sweet little Susie," because Susie's being a pill. She's being angry or feisty or whatever. And some mothers will only affirm the child if the child fits in with the mother's agenda. Tragedy, horrible thing, because the child learns that it's not safe to be strong. It's not safe to be pouty or mean, or, you know, that there are certain emotions that I cannot share. And when we look at the lost coin, we'll see that people who struggle with this feel that they always have to show the shiny side. They always have to do what's expected of them. They only feel comfortable when they feel like they're connected with someone who is giving them a message that they have value and worth. And unfortunately, some parents can only give that message when the child is fitting in with their plan. The third possibility for disruption in this progression is if a child has successfully bonded and successfully established their own identity, their own will, their own assertiveness, been able to express their feelings. If they're in a family that does not provide good structures, consistent boundaries, good limits, and if the rules are not based on the child's good, but rather based on what the parents want, you know, some parents are just like, "You sit down and shut up," and it has nothing to do with the kid's good. It's because the parent is pissed. The parent is, you know, the kid is interfering with the parent's comfort or watching TV or whatever, and the rules are all about protecting the parents and not protecting the kids. And so a child who's in that situation has a hard time yielding, has a hard time fitting into that. And so the kid may obey on the outside. It's like the kid, his parent says, "Sit down and shut up." And the kid's like, "I'll sit down, but I'm standing up on the inside." You know, they develop a mentality that, like, nobody is going to look out for me, so I'm going to look out for myself. And they learn to push their way through life. They learn to get whatever they can. They're good at saying no. They're good at saying what's mine. And they figure that if anybody's going to take care of me, I'm going to have to take care of myself. And they become like the prodigal son, somebody who has to do it their way. And they have a strength, but it also gets into big trouble. And some of you know that experientially, but we'll look at it in a couple of weeks and see what happens for that pusher when push comes to shove. If the child has successfully bonded, separated, and released, but is in a family where it is not where risk is not encouraged, where there's a strong sense of right and wrong and legalism and doing it by the book, then the child may get stuck in accommodation or yielding. The child may get stuck in pleasing or justifying. I grew up in the Church of Christ, which is very legalistic, and it was important to me to do things by the book. I can tell you, I wanted to get everybody's approval. I wanted God's stamp of approval. And so when it came time for me to move toward adulthood, I was very much stuck in a pleasing mode. It did not feel safe for me to say yes to God or to pursue things in life unless I felt confident that it was right, that it was safe, that I was not going to take any risk of being wrong. And the older brother in the parable that we'll be looking at is somebody who embodies that that particular problem of a relationship that looks a little, doesn't look quite as bad on the surface as these other things. But it turns out to be one of the most debilitating things when we live life not to lose, when we live life to to stay in the lines, to not risk, that when it becomes more important for us not to fail than it does for us to pursue our dreams. And if we don't feel confident that we can get what we want by doing it a certain way, we may back off from it. Rather than saying yes, we say maybe. We put things off. We put the responsibility on others. Well, we're over time, but I just wanted to present this model, and it may be very familiar to some of you, maybe brand new to others. I've kind of run through it, but I think that it will begin to give you a view of where we're going to be going over the next few weeks. I really believe that even if you're not completely clear about it, if you'll keep coming back, this model will excite you, because what we're going to look at is not only how it gets us into trouble, but how God, through the words of the Beatitudes, has given us a path to renegotiate these tasks of development. Jesus says, unless you be born again, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. Unless you become like a little child, you can't enjoy all that the kingdom has for you. So for every person in this room, I believe that as we go through the lost sheep, the lost coin, the prodigal son, and the older brother, you're going to find yourself. You're going to see times when you withdraw, when you need to press in. Times when you need to, when you cling, when you need to let go. Times when you push, when you need to surrender. And times when you try to please, when you really need to step out and do whatever is on your heart to do, even if the whole world is against you. And I think if you'll keep coming back, you'll see that the kingdom is so ready to reclaim all that the enemy has taken from you. So ready to empower you to live a life of freedom and joy. Let's pray. God, we thank you for your purpose in calling us to you. We thank you that we are made for you, that all of our human relationships prepare us for life with you. And Lord, we thank you that it's in our brokenness when we encounter you the most powerfully. Lord, help us this day to step into freedom, to take risks, to trust you more fully, to live freely and love deeply, Lord, as you would have us. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.